We now have the largest trade deficit with China that any country has ever had with another. You can just look around and look at the empty factories. Look at Detroit. It's a completely, it looks like it was taken over by a foreign country and bombed out because all those factories are gone now. The people that run things, the 1%, they want the cheapest labor possible. So these trade deals work to that effect because they outsource factories to countries that will pay slave labor, so that makes their profit margins go up. And that's literally all they care about. There's obviously a predilection amongst our leaders for when they have everything else that they can have, when they have the money and the power, that's their go-to move. They want to have sex with children. Yeah. The average American just kind of look, oh, that's crazy. And that's, again, they don't want to confront it. And that's the problem all of us face when we're trying to wake people up, is that they just, a lot of them just would rather sleep.
Welcome to Business Game Changers. I'm Sarah Westall. I have Donald Jeffries joining the show, and he wrote this book called The Survival of the Richest. And very good book. And we talk about the left-right paradigm being a farce, and he gives lots of examples on why it's a farce. And all the better treatment that the wealthy and the really wealthy and the politically connected people get in society, and also the corruption and the corruption beyond what people even can remotely let themselves mentally, very dark, dark corruption that's going on, and they still are immune from justice for following the rule of law. And he talks about how there is this vast difference in how we're losing our middle class. But I like the fact that he's looking at truth. He's not looking at the whole left-right paradigm farce and why it's not real, especially at the highest levels and especially in international policy. It's what we want as Americans is very rarely implemented by our Congress and by our government. It just like Syria, nobody wants it. Over 80% of Americans do not want to be at war with Syria, but yet we still are there. We have been. It doesn't matter what we think, we still do it. And we talk about a lot of that. And he sticks around and he talks about the next book that he's doing on crimes in history and corruption and conspiracies in history. And he's going to talk about Lincoln and some truths about Lincoln that's going to be really controversial for people. But he's going to give us some of that for my Patreons. If you sign up for my, you can sign up for as little as $1 a month or more if you can afford that. And if you can't afford to sign up, let me know and I'll get you some of this content for free. I don't want people to be without it just because they can't afford it. But before we get into that show, I want to remind you that the food revolution is starting April 28th. So to join that, I have a link below and you're going to learn so much by going to that. They brought in the top 24 scientists they could find in the world to talk about what the reality is with food, brain health, gut, diabetes, cancer, all sorts of things on what the latest science is saying about food. It's very different than what we get in mainstream media. Very different. Very different we get from mainstream anything that we have, what the government puts out with the food chart. Just throw all that away and you're going to hear what the latest science is on it. It's all free. Starts April 28th. Now you can buy, if you buy, get it before it starts, something like $67 to get all the speakers plus another 2,000 reports. Very inexpensive, but during the summit, it's $99 for all of that, and then afterwards, it's $199, so great deal anyways, but if you can't afford that, you can watch this and take notes, something that might bug you, like your gut or whatever. Highly recommend it, because there is the latest science and research on what's really going on in that industry from people who don't have agendas, which is what you want to look for. So let's get into this interview now with Donald Jeffries. Hi, Don. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Sarah.
Well, thank you for coming on. I wanted to talk to you because you have, you believe the left-right paradigm is a farce, like I do. And so I want to talk about some of the problems that we have in the United States and how both sides are contributing to this problem. And one, they both talk out of the, you know, out of their arse, if you will. And they're not, they say one thing, do another. And it shows that the left-right paradigm is a farce. But let's start talking about trade agreements. One of the big things, you wrote a book recently on the conspiracy of wealth and so forth, and I want you to talk about your book later. But One of the big problems you state is our trade agreements. Can you talk about that? Why is our trade agreements such a big source of our issues?
Well, I think the trade agreements go hand in hand with the outsourcing of our industry. When we all the factories left our shores, especially with NAFTA being passed in the early 90s, and Ross Perot warned us about that giant sucking sound that would happen, and we've seen that. I mean, I have the statistics in my book, Survival of the Richest, but we went from having a trade surplus, I believe, with Mexico to having like $1 billion-plus trade deficit with them. We now have the largest trade deficit with China that any country has ever had with another. It's because all our electronic products, so forth, are made in China, and other countries like that that use slave labor. We don't have factories making those products anymore. So it's not just the trade agreements, it's what happens ancillary to those trade agreements, because the trade agreements, as Ross Perot and others at the time warned, we saw industry leave our shores and those jobs are gone. So people aren't making any products here. So we're dependent on countries, either third world countries like Mexico, which we can't possibly compete with on a level playing field because they're paying their workers slave labor. We can't do that and survive as a first world nation. And with China, you're talking about a totalitarian regime that, again, is paying its workers nothing. So it's not a level playing field. We could have a free trade agreement, for instance, with Canada or the nations in Europe. But we cannot possibly have an agreement with countries like that. And you can see what has happened, though. We not only have trade deficits with these countries, but it has led to the lowering of wages and benefits, along with lots of other factors. But when you don't build anything as a country, you're dependent on other nations that do. And you can just look around and look at the empty factories. Look at Detroit. It looks like it was taken over by a foreign country and bombed out because all those factories are gone now.
Well, my thing is that as we start to work worldwide, everybody balances out in theory, right? Theory doesn't always apply because you have governments and all these other things doing weird things. But the biggest problem I have is the incentives for China to work with us in ways that, you know, bring product in that hurts us. For example, they have subsidies for shipping. So it's less expensive for them to produce a product and ship it to us, then somebody has to pay just to ship it, you know, like right. A local person. So it's not just the opening up a fair trade agreement. They actually made it, rigged it against us, made it even harder than competing against just their wages.
Sure, and I think that's really doesn't surprise many people because, you know, what kind of people have been running China for a long time. Again, it's a totalitarian regime, so to expect them to play fair or whatever is being incredibly naive. That's why to make those kind of agreements with countries like that or third world nations that can't hope to compete with first world wages and benefits is disastrous, and that's what we've seen in President Trump's tariffs on China recently were kind of a refreshing step, I guess, but without factories being brought back to America, it's meaningless. All it means is you may pay more for those products, because if you don't have some competition here in the United States where you can actually buy American, we used to hear as recently as 20, 30 years ago, buy American. Well, there's just not much American product that you can buy now, because we're not building anything. You need to bring those factories back. Then the tariffs will have an impact because we'll have something to compete with. But as long as we're not producing anything, it's really kind of an empty gesture.
Well, there are some factories in manufacturing that have shown a lot of promise, where they've figured out how to be profitable doing higher end products and doing things that where we can compete. Have you looked into some of that?
Well, certainly we still have some factories, but I think it's more, as you talk about high-end factories and so forth, where I'm looking to, when I talk about the things I talk about in my book, I'm talking about what happened to all the people that used to work in those factories, the unskilled labor. Those factories, we need to have that kind of mass production brought back or something like it, because you're not going to be right now. We already have lots of college graduates saddled with student loans that are not getting their full money's worth for what they're paying. Certainly, they're getting jobs that used to go to high school graduates. And all those unskilled people that used to work in the factories are still there, the next generation or the next two generations from the World War II era, say. Well, what are they supposed to do? Not everyone has the aptitude for college, and with more college diplomas, obviously each one is watered down and the value is less. So we need to have somewhere for those people to work. They used to be able to make a good middle-class living doing that. All those people are still there, but what they're purposely being sunk down into poverty by these disastrous trade agreements, immigration, just the policies of our leaders. They've all combined to lower the standard of living for the vast majority of Americans.
Just a quick break from the program to tell you about another summit that's coming up, and it's about ketones. And everybody, the rage has been about ketones because it helps burn fat and reduce inflammation. They have a series of videos that are going to start May 7th. And what you will learn is how ketones help you burn fat for energy, reduce inflammation, and how they may help prevent and eradicate diabetes, cancer, autoimmune deficiencies. And what you'll learn in this health summit is, what is ketosis? How does it work? And how to separate fact from fiction? How to overcome the challenges of being keto adapted, whether you should start a keto diet or not, how to shop, live, and eat in a ketogenic lifestyle, and how you can do a keto, whether you're a meat eater, a vegetarian, or vegan even. So I will have that information below. Sign up before the Health Summit starts on May 7th if you want access to discounts. Me, for one, I want a way to be able to burn more fat. Trust me, as I get older, it's becoming harder and harder. So let's get back into our interview now. Well, one of the things that I was happy about is pulling out of TPP. And yeah. I have a thing that says bottom five things that Trump has done. And one of them is pulling out of TPP is one of the better things he's done. But now he's re-looking at joining it again. What do you think of that, and why is he doing that?
Yeah, well, I mean, it goes with his personality. It was very nice to see him do that right away, too. It was really the only promise he kept right up front. And I was certainly pleased with that. But what we know of his personality now, he'll probably claim it's the best TPP ever. This is the greatest. You know, he'll brag about how much better it is. And that's the kind of thing I think you get with Trump. And people, I think, understand his personality at this point. And I don't expect him to do much of anything. And TPP is probably the fact that he pulled out of that is maybe his only real promise that he kept from his campaign so far. So it wouldn't be surprising to see him go back on that. And he'll try to claim again that this is a new and different, a new improved, kinder and gentler TPP or something. But it's a disastrous deal any way you look at it. We don't need those kind of deals. We need to be making America great, like he claimed, and putting America first. We need to actually start our own production so we can give jobs to our own people. And but all of this revolves around, Sarah, cheap, all these issues we talk about, it's all about getting the cheapest labor possible. Whether it's trade deals, immigration, or anything else, the people that run things, the 1%, they want the cheapest labor possible. So these trade deals work to that effect because they outsource factories to countries that will pay slave labor, so that makes their profit margins go up. And that's literally all they care about. They're not like Henry Ford was back in the 1930s, where he was an anti-union guy. But he said, I've got to pay, he gave his workers a pay raise, he says, I have to pay my workers enough to buy my product.
Well, yeah, I know. I had a union kind of situation, and I didn't like the union being in there either. Nobody likes the union being in there because they dictate to you how to run your company. So any company owner, I don't know how they can possibly like that. But I was paying my people really good, and they had health benefits and everything else. So it was fairly on par with what they expected anyways. But I didn't want them telling me what to do. But I got to say, Trump has done some other things, promises. He has lowered corporate tax. Corporate tax was the highest in the world for the United States. Sure, there's loopholes, but loopholes is a different issue. The corporate tax that affected the retailer down the street was lowered to average in the world. And what that was doing, it was incenting countries to keep their money offshore by having corporate tax so high. So by doing that, that incented a lot of companies to bring their money back. So that was a good thing. And then he also did some other, you know, things that he has promised, that people, like regulations, got rid of some regulations. People who voted for him wanted less regulations. He's also clamping down on corruption as far as pedophilia and some of the trafficking goes. But we haven't seen any arrests at the higher level.
Yeah, right.
We see just a lower level, and there's all these sealed indictments, but we haven't seen any arrests. And it kind of gets back to what you've talked about in your book, that there isn't an equal justice. It's like the laws are for the peasants. So can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, that's why people, I mean, we don't want to focus strictly on Hillary Clinton, but that's why the lock her up thing was so popular with Trump supporters, because she kind of represents that elite. She represents the establishment. Her husband was president. She was trying to become president. She's had a whole career of corruption dating back to the Watergate committee that she was served on as a young lawyer. When you see people like that, that despite charges and accusations and slimy deals for decades, when people like, and I don't need to focus just on her, but she's certainly not alone,
exactly.
But people like that don't go to prison. And that's what I talk about in my book. I give example after example, whether it's professional football players or corporate CEO, they're above the law. The laws and the punitive punishments are for, you know, the people living in the inner cities and the trailer parks, the average Joe that's caught. You know, if you're caught drunk driving, if you're an average person, your life is ruined. Mothers Against Drunk Drivers will sit outside the courtroom and pressure the judge to throw the book at you. But if you're a professional football player or an illegal immigrant, interestingly enough, you're not. You get away with it and you can have 7-8 drunk driving arrests and nothing happens. You're still driving and Mothers Against Drunk Drivers is invisible. I actually tried to contact them while writing Survival of the Richest, just to focus on the case of one professional football player who wasn't even any good. He was a mediocre run-of-the-mill player, Dante Stallworth. He was arrested and charged with a hit-and-run accident while driving drunk. He killed someone. So he could have faced up to 20 years in prison. He served 20 days.
Oh,
and
my gosh.
And that's what happened. And he still had NFL teams interested, and the NFL couldn't even make an example out of him and say, we don't want somebody like that. Now, if he had done something politically incorrect, I'm sure they would have said, no, we don't want you anymore. But something like that, they couldn't even make a gesture like that. And that's what we get. We get businesses that won't even make a stand like that. And the law is so obviously, there's two standards of justice. I spoke in my earlier book, Hidden History, I quoted someone that said that he'd been in prison for decades, and he never met anybody who had even been close to being wealthy before they went to prison. Prisons are for the poor. And, you know, you might have some white collar prisons, which are not the same kind of thing. So if you're any kind of a celebrity, you have any kind of money, you have nothing to worry about, because you're going to find a lenient judge. You're going to find a starstruck jury. And most of the time, the prosecutors aren't even going to prosecute you. You're not even going to have to worry about having the jury find you not guilty, which they will virtually every time. And that's the problem, is that it's not that necessarily, we already have more people in prison than any country has ever had in the history of the world. But almost all of them are poor, or certainly at least lower middle class. The people at the top, as you mentioned, the Podestas, the Clintons, and so forth, they're probably guilty of some really slimy things, things we can't even imagine when you get into the pedophilia area, for instance. But nothing is happening to them. Like some of Trump's supporters that are frustrated say, where are the arrests? Where are people like that?
It's so bad. I mean, some of the things they've done are so bad, so obvious, and what it does is it really gives you a disdain for the rule of law and for our country when those kind of lowlives get away with what they're doing.
Sure. Well, a law is meaningless if it's not applied to everyone. A rule is meaningless. And that's the problem with our society at all levels, whether it's because of political correctness, the rules and the standards of conduct, the expectations are all different for different groups. And it shouldn't be. There should be, if it's a rule, it should apply to everyone. If it's a law, it should apply to everyone. There shouldn't be different standards. But for some reason, America, and maybe it's that way around much of the world, I don't know, but I can only comment on America. We just won't apply the laws evenly. And we never have. You can go back to the old boy network, and now you have the political correctness stuff, politically motivated things. But certainly anybody that has any kind of money or standing in society. And I just think as a gesture, if Hillary Clinton went to prison and for instance, and actually served time, I'm just, again, using her as an example, I think that symbolically, that would send a powerful message that,
exactly.
Okay, you're not above the law, but we never get those messages sent. And if someone ever did do that, I you know, people like me that are cynical would probably wonder, wow, wait a minute, what? Maybe there was actually some good there because she went to prison, because that's how rare it would be.
Well, and Podesta, I mean, they have those drawings showing them. I mean, it's a direct, obvious, you know, with that little girl in Europe. It's like, how, that's so bad. I'm just like, why? What is wrong with people that we can't be ethical and that we get starstruck. I mean, what's the deal with stars? They're just people like anybody else.
Well, I think that was the most disturbing part of writing my earlier book, Hidden History. I had a whole section on the Franklin Credits scandal and all the child sex scandals. I mean, they're out there. They're real. And Americans don't want to go there. They don't want to go down that rabbit hole. So many of these things are so deep down the rabbit hole when you go down them, and they're frightening. But there's obviously a predilection amongst our leaders for when they have everything else that they can have, when they have the money and the power. That's their go-to move. They want to have sex with children. And I don't really understand it. Most of us can't understand it, but it's there. I don't know if it's something they have to do to be recruited into it or something, and then that's used as blackmail over them. But we see it everywhere. The accounts are everywhere. And people can look at my chapter online, and the late Dave McGowan wrote a great piece online called The Pedocracy, or it's pedophilia, but Pedocracy, I don't know how to even pronounce it, but where he talked about, and not only America, but around the world. I mean, this stuff is a reality. So when Pizzagate broke and everything, it was there to see. And unfortunately, people kind of backed away from that. I don't really know why, because as you mentioned, the picture of the little girl duct taped to the table and things like that, the kill room and the jokes they were making about it. I mean, I don't know what's going on there. And again, we can't even, the average normal person just trying to live their life can't even comprehend that. And that's the problem we have trying to convince people of any of this stuff, is that no one wants to look at and confront the reality of what's there, because it's so dark and disturbing that people would rather turn the other way and just turn the TV on and watch a reality show.
But how can people who are confronted with it turn the other cheek? I mean, it's so bad. I mean, I feel like now that I know, I can't do anything else. You obviously felt that way too. You wrote a whole, part of your book on that. Once you know, how can a decent human being not make that one of their things they stand against? I don't know how you can't.
Well, I agree with you, but it takes a lot of courage, and you have to, one man alone or one woman alone trying to fight something this monstrous and this huge. I mean, you need whether it's fighting a corrupt government or just something like this, where it's one disturbing element of the way our leaders conduct themselves behind closed doors. It takes numbers. And you're not going to, because all of us, we don't want to risk our careers, and certainly all the unnatural deaths that we've seen. I mean, Hidden History is full of those, and Survival of the Richest touched on a little bit too, where people that look into these matters tend to die unnaturally. So, most of us don't want to be falling out of a high-rise building or, getting in plane crashes and things like that. Or as my friend Dave McGowan, he develops one of the fastest cases of galloping cancer I've ever seen. It was very, very disturbing. And, he wrote about all these kinds of things. And so it's scary when you see that, and when you see what happens to the real whistleblowers out there. The Bradley Chelsea Mannings and the Edward Snowdens, I mean, Julian Assange. I mean, they're either in prison or they're exiled from America. So, and Americans, if you look at the public polls, they don't even support these people. Overwhelmingly, they believe the government lies. Yeah, so they don't want the truth, apparently. So if you had some kind of whistleblower that was able to somehow get exposure about, and we saw some of that with Julian Assange, the whole Pizzagate controversy was born because of those emails that he released, Podesta's emails and some of the other emails touching on him. We talked about the pizza-related maps and all the kind of crazy stuff that we all read online. Americans don't seem to have been interested in that. I mean, so-called conspiracy theorists like us were, but the average American just kind of look, oh, that's crazy. And that's, again, they don't want to confront it. And that's the problem all of us face when we're trying to wake people up, is that they just, a lot of them just would rather sleep.
It's easier to sleep. it actually is.
It is.
I was happier back then. Actually, yeah. I'm not. I couldn't be happy hiding from the truth. I just wish there was more people that would face it and say, okay, I don't want any part of this, and we need to at least do your part. And there's so many listeners that in the comments, they say, I'm awake, but everyone around me, I don't know how to speak to them. So do you have any words for wisdom? I mean, I totally agree with them. I've found myself, I'm slowly waking up my family, my parents, my sisters, and they've come a long way. But yeah, what words of wisdom do you have for people? And how do we wake people up that are just around us?
Well, I have been only really partially successful. I have a huge family, and I wrote a piece on my blog recently called "How to Become Unpopular," and it was just basically becoming a published author and writing this stuff. I mean, so I've lost lots of friends. I mean, I guess I don't believe in the left paradigm like you. I mean, I'm a populist or a classical liberal. So I'm far left on most issues, but I'm far right on some. And I hate establishment liberals. So I don't get along with what should naturally be my base. And because I don't like social justice warrior kind of stuff. I don't like political correctness. But on the other hand, I am concerned about the disparity of wealth. And I think the common people are getting screwed over constantly. So that kind of thing, if people around you are even moderately successful, and this, all they're looking at is that. Are they doing okay? Their kids are doing okay? Everything's fine. I mean, that's the way they look at it. They can't look beyond their own circumstances. And that's the problem with much of what we face is if someone is doing okay, then in their own little world, and America's great, the system's working great, yeah, they have some kind of a vague concept that, yeah, they're probably all corrupt at the top, but what can I do about it? That's it. And, I've got to go, how's the stock market doing? You know, am I going to get a bonus? Did my kid get into this college? That's what their concerns are. And to get them to understand the bigger picture, well, the economy can't continue like this when you have 50% of the country, the bottom 50%, making $27,000 or less. And that's what the statistics tell us. You can't have a first world country doing that. Half the country has nothing. And with each new wave of immigration that comes, it's coming at the very bottom. People that are worse poverty than anyone in America. So they're adding to that and they're dragging that. They're increasing that 50%. So the middle class is being squeezed out because we know the people at the top are doing great all the time because the wealth is being transferred upward. So it's that middle class that's being squeezed out. And that's what made America great. At one point was having that thriving middle class. So, but again, if people are still in that middle class or they're doing well enough, they're just not seeing it. And all they're caring about is themselves. It's the old looking out for number one, he who dies with the most toys wins mentality that we saw that was had a disastrous impact of thinking on a whole generation of Americans.
Well, let's talk about some of the hypocrisy that you're seeing. You know, the people out there talking about what you're talking about. They're out there trying to make it more fair for the poor, but they are the biggest hypocrites around. Can you talk? You have a lot of examples in your book. Can you talk about that?
Well, sure. I mean, we have already seen the people like the Al Gores, Jesse Jacksons, the Clintons, and so forth. They almost always tend to donate the least amount to charities. That kind of thing. Then, and Al Gore, the people that, or any of your celebrities. Leonardo DiCaprio, people like that, that'll flying in on their private jet to lecture people about their carbon footprint. They don't see the irony in that, Al Gore, I believe he set the record at one point for one of his residences for the most wasted electricity or something. I was reading online about it. So it's one rule for you: do as I say, not as I do. It's the old admonition that a lot of us used to hear from our bosses. Back in the old days, do as I say, not as I do. And you'd see somebody being hypocritical. Celebrities are the most hypocritical, certainly liberals. Again, the establishment liberals. And when I say that, I'm talking about, I differentiate between the Clintons, the Obamas, the Al Gores, the Joe Bidens, the Nancy Pelosi's, with people that are my friends like Cynthia McKinney, Cindy
Love
Sheehan,
her.
The international PA, Cindy Sheehan, Dennis Kucinich. These, Marcy Kaptur's still pretty good that's in Congress. These are a completely different kind of left, and I write about that in history, where people think of the left and they think of people like Franklin Roosevelt and Theodore Roosevelt and Clarence Darrow and Woodrow Wilson, and these are what I call the establishment left, the Clintons of their day, where if you look at their records, they were always for war. They never really did anything to help anyone, but you had people back then, my hero Huey Long, Eugene Debs, Robert La Follette. These are the populists of the day who were trying to do something for people and who weren't for war. General Smedley Butler. No, the people like that. who wrote War is a Racket. So I think there's a left, and there's an establishment left, and then there's a left where I'm comfortable in, the left that still reveres Thomas Jefferson and Patrick Henry and Charles Dickens, people like that, that were trying to write about reforms and wanted to do good things. But the left today is primarily interested in getting people fired and, watching, policing their thought. And, you know, what did you say? And you know, just going after people for the slip of a tongue if they said something politically correct, ruining their lives and pouncing on them like a tiger. That seems to be their only reason for existence now, is to police thought and to stifle defense, to dissent, to not let people say, you know, why are these people, why are they marching? They don't have any right to do that. Punch Nazis in the face, that kind of attitude, where they determine who Nazis are, that kind of thing. They're concerned with tearing down Confederate statues, but they're not concerned with the fact that one out of every three black men is in prison or whatever. That doesn't bother them, that the Clintons, when they reformed the three strikes you're out and mandatory sentence laws back in the 90s, where it resulted in tons and tons of black people being in prison. They don't care about that, but they do care about the Confederate statue. And that's in microcosm, that's what's wrong with America, because we don't have that kind of classic liberalism out there, except with the people like Cynthia McKinney, who was drummed out of Congress, and Cindy Sheehan, who's kind of isolated out there in California and doing what she does. Gerald Celente is another great one, you know, who has the Occupy Peace thing. But we're being run by an establishment left and an establishment right that agree on everything. That's why when Trump bombed Syria the both times he did, suddenly the Hillary Clintons and the John McCainiacs and the Lindsey Grahams and people like that, suddenly they love that. They supported that. And that ought to tell Trump something, that those aren't the people he wants the support of if he's going to keep his promises.
Well, over 80%, I saw a survey that over 80% of the people are against war with Syria in the United States. People don't want it. You know, so they're not doing what the people want. They're doing what the establishment wants. And, you know, the people are dying. Veterans are coming back. Suicide rates are off the chart. They don't want this, but it doesn't matter. You know, the Obamacare debacle, the nightmare with that. I see the far left being so, this is where the hypocrisy comes in. They see it as such a great thing, but yet more people are not getting health care because they can't afford it than before the Obamacare, because they can't afford the payments, the down payments to go and all these other things. So more people have lost health care, but they're happy with it because the poor people got on it. It's like, well, you got to look at the big picture with this stuff, and they're just not intellectually honest about what's really going on in this. They're just so blinded by their ideals, and to the point where they're opposite of what they claim to be.
Right. And they're not everything they do. I mean, I'm fond of saying, and it's one of my talking points since my first book was published, is that you could get any random group of preschoolers anywhere across this country and put them in charge and they'd do a better job. We have awful leadership at all levels. I mean, they are just, and you could get any random group of death row inmates and they'd be more principled in running things. I mean,
isn't that crazy?
We're dealing with absolute corruption and absolute incompetence. It's a mishmash, a cocktail of it. So to expect them, I mean, our medical, I call it the medical industrial complex, and it's awful. There's so much waste. There's so much profit on the part of pharmaceutical companies, big pharma, the insurance companies. And when Obamacare went into being, he let the insurance companies write that plan. And unfortunately, what we have is you had the what I call fake opposition. The fake opposition to Obama was always based on this premise that he was a Muslim and that he was basically being a wimp when he was bombing seven countries at once, and that he was somehow a socialist who was giving us a single payer system, when all he did was take a system that was already as bad as it can get and make it worse by putting the mandate in, by forcing people to buy it. And instead of doing something about how, you know, they really wanted to reform the medical industrial complex or anything else, they would have brought the right people in. You would have brought in the CEOs of these hospitals and healthcare systems. You would have brought in the CEOs of the pharmaceutical companies and the insurance industry. And I have tons of examples in Survival of the Richest about how much these people are making. And you'd grill them on it. Humiliate them in front of the public. You know, why did you get a $400 million bonus or whatever? That kind of thing. make them justify that. And why is a patient in America having to pay, you know, $500 for a bottle of pills that he can go to Cuba and get for 3 cents?
Exactly.
You know, I mean, one of the few good things Michael Moore did in Sicko, he pointed out a few good things about that. And one of the examples that I was particularly impressed with is that, you know, how can a backwards nation or third world nation like Cuba produce something for their people that's that much cheaper, regardless of anything else about them? But that's the kind of thing we need to address, is we're doing it the wrong way, however you look at it. But for some reason, so many Americans just, you know, they seem to love this and they cling to it. And I don't know why. We're paying more taxes for healthcare than socialist countries do for single-payer systems. We're not getting anything. And that's what I'm fond of saying about our government as a whole. We pay so much. We pay for a socialist nanny state, cradle to grave, but we get almost no services. Our roads and bridges are crumbling. Our airports and railroads are out there. Our power grids are a joke. So that's why Trump, again, was so appealing when he finally, the first man in the public eye in my lifetime, called out the embarrassing nature of our infrastructure. It's a third world infrastructure, and it needs to be rebuilt, but we're too busy bombing other countries and lining the pockets of these politicians. And again, it all goes to the fact that the people in charge, just everything they're doing is wrong. I mean, they're not going in the right direction on any single.
They don't care. Well, and all the money that was stolen, you know, Catherine Austin Fitz and Professor Skidmore just had a Department of Defense and the HUD found over $21 trillion missing.
Yep.
I mean, what the heck?
Sure.
Why isn't that front page news? You know, I keep saying, why isn't that front page news? Our infrastructure's crumbling. People can't afford health care. And there's $21 trillion and the media doesn't give a crap?
Right.
Well, I mean, going on?
Well, I'm one of the few people that still bring up the Grace Commission back in the 1980s. Ronald Reagan had so many chances to get this under control. And Trump reminds me so much of Reagan in many ways, where there was such a promise to get rid of government waste and regulations back in the 80s. And Reagan did absolutely nothing. And I have his record in my book, along with the records of all these administrations. But the Grace Commission was one of the few apparently honest commissions that was tasked to look into the issue of how government money was spent back in the 80s. They came up with a mind-boggling statistic that said that one-third of all government spending was total waste. This was back in the 80s. So you could cut taxes and spending by one-third and not a penny would be cut from any program. Just get rid of the absolute waste. I can't believe that hasn't increased by now. But even if it's still just one-third, that would be the first step to do. Get rid of all the waste, all the fraud and abuse. But no one wants to go there because these people are living off that system. They're profiting from it. And as you mentioned, we don't have political representation. We have taxation without representation, which, this country was born because of taxation without representation. You talked about 80% against the Syria war. Well, during the banker bailout in 2008, most polls showed 95-96% of Americans dead set against that. Yet all the leaders on both the left and the right, are only two presidential candidates, all of them were for the banker bailout. And the banks got it, and we saw what happened. What happened? Instead of – these weren't welfare recipients, which we're told all the time, you know, if you give any of these people anything, they're just going to go out and waste it and to be irresponsible and spend it on drugs and sex and rock and roll or whatever. You know, they're going to waste it. But these banks – were as irresponsible as the biggest crack addict as you could find. Six of the nine banks that we gave those bailouts to, they gave out more in bonuses that year than their company made in profits. Now, I'd like any capitalist explain to me how that's even a business model. And yet they'll tell you if they raise the minimum wage or give the people at the bottom anything, oh, you'll be paying so much for money. Well, you're running a company where you're giving out more in bonuses than your company is making in profit. I don't know how you can survive, but that's the mysterious
place. There, you know, when you see that stuff, that's a little odd. But just anything you see that's an anomaly, you know there's something crooked going on. One thing that I didn't know is Michael Moore, how much of a hypocrite he actually is. I've learned some things from his documentaries, but he's a hypocrite. And I didn't know to the level of seven homes, and he has all these things, and he says one thing and does another. He's like all the rest of them, but you wouldn't know based on the way he acts in the movies he does. At least he puts information out there. But then you look at like Alex Jones. I just put up a interview that I did with Adam Green about Alex Jones, because he is looks like he's compromised. He won't talk about certain things like Israel. He will not. Israel's off the table. You can't even use the word Zionism. You cannot talk about the politics of Israel. You can talk about any other country but that. You can't use certain words.
Right.
And what the heck is that? You know what? We don't have a free media. And so we brought Alex Jones to the table and said, you're compromised. You're not actually, you won't even use the word Zionist. You used to. Now you're not. Now the funny thing is I put that thing up and I can't believe how many people unsubscribed to my channel just because we told the truth on it.
Yeah, well, that's, I mean, well, the problem that we have with people like Alex Jones is that we need someone to try to just tell the absolute truth, to not hold back. You're not, I mean, and Alex Jones will still be called anti-Semitic and racist, even though, as you mentioned, he bends over backwards, not even to mention Israel. And I believe at one point he talked about Saudi Arabia or running Hollywood or something. I mean, ludicrous stuff like that. Just tell the truth. It is what it is. I mean, unfortunately, Israel runs our foreign policy, and they have for a long time. And again, it goes back to the Reagan era when the neocons were first born, when basically Israel took over our foreign policy. And that doesn't mean that we hate Israel. We don't hate Jews by saying that. It is what it is. We shouldn't be. And as there's actually more dissent in Israel than there is in the halls of America, as far as the elite. In terms of Israel, I mean, we go back to a book's been written about back to the 80s. There was a representative called Paul Findlay, whose career was ruined because he went up against AIPAC, you know, which is the most powerful lobbying arm as far as pressuring Congress. But you don't see much about that. That guy, he had a fairly well-selling book at that time, but his career was effectively over. He had a couple other politicians. I believe it was Paul McCloskey was another guy that was run out of Congress because of Israel. You can't go up against Israel. And I think that was one of Cynthia McKinney's many problems, is that she, you know, she would not hold back in terms of that. But if you're looking at our foreign policy, if there's to be any kind of debate, and we know we hear all the time about a bipartisan foreign policy, which just basically means there's to be no debate. That's why it's all war all the time. If, as you mentioned, 80% against Syria. If you had a genuine peace candidate who could articulate those feelings, I can't believe that they wouldn't be elected, because it's so obvious to point out the fallacies of our foreign policy. It's, what are we doing? We don't have money. You claim we're going to have to raise the gas tax or something if you finally do something about our roads and bridges and power grids. Somehow we don't have the money for that, but we always have the money for the latest strike on Syria. Or whatever we're doing, whatever foreign misadventure, we always had the money for that. And part of that is, as you mentioned, the money missing from the Pentagon and everywhere else. The intelligence budgets are still top secret. We don't even know what their budgets are, let alone what they're being spent on. I think we have the right to do that, and we maybe might object then if we figure out how are this being spent, especially when we have a crumbling infrastructure that desperately needs to be fixed.
Well, and we have so many veterans that are committing suicide. You know, I did a graph. We have more veterans that are committing suicide in the last 15 years than died in combat in Vietnam. We've just bypassed World War I. We're about half to World War II. But we have those kind of losses of our vets. And at what point do we say this foreign policy isn't for us, it's for Israel, and BS? That's not right. We're paying the taxes where our people are dying left and right because they're so mentally damaged of what we're doing. And we keep doing it. I mean, at some point we have to say, this isn't for us. This isn't what's right for us.
Right. Well, I guess, and it goes back to, again, even with the awful presidential choices we have, if people just stopped reelecting all their incumbents in Congress, and I don't know why 96% of incumbents get reelected, whether it's because of massing voter fraud, which probably is. But if Americans are actually returning the Nancy Pelosi's, the John McCain's, the Lindsey Graham's, people like that to Congress that have proven how utterly awful they are, why anybody would be satisfied with those choices is beyond me, but they keep getting reelected over and over again. So if you don't change, we'd need an infusion of at least 300 decent people in Congress. And with something like that, with a majority in Congress, then we could overturn all this stuff. You could actually impeach the corrupt presidents. You could do something to rewrite some of the awful decisions of the Supreme Court to make it so that they can be removed, so they don't have lifetime tenure and that kind of thing. And the legislative branch, under the checks and balances, is supposed to be an equal branch, but they gave up their equality a long time ago. We have strong presidents, imperial presidencies. Virtually everyone is an imperial president, and the Supreme Court has been legislating since John Marshall. They overstepped their boundaries. Thomas Jefferson warned about that even before. You look at some of the stuff he wrote about that's what they didn't want. And yet that's what we have. And the legislative branch has always been the least powerful branch. And it's the branch that's closest to the people, because theoretically we can overturn them every 2 years, at least one house. But we don't do that even when we have the chance to. And whether that's because of the voter's stupidity, which it could be, or because of massive voting fraud, which I think it is, or at least a combination. But we have to do something, because you can't, as you said, you can't expect as long as you have the same people in there, they're not going to change, because the system has been very good to them. It's worked perfectly for them. Why would they change? If you're doing well, your family's doing well, your future's set, your children's future is set, just by nature of you voting the way Israel wants, listening to the big bankers, listening to the powerful lobbyists, then you're probably not going to have the principles to buck that, because you're going to suffer, your family's going to suffer, and probably no one's going to stand beside you. So I said, you need 300 people in there. You don't need one.
Exactly.
You saw what happened to Cynthia McKinney and Dennis Kucinich, people like that. They're drummed out. Even Ron Paul, people like that. So I don't know.
And Cynthia McKinney, she's had every person around her killed. You need to support those people. It's not fair to put them up there and have them be a punching bag. Poor Cynthia McKinney needs help. You need to vote in a whole bunch of people like her, or at least people that will follow her, so that she's not alone.
Exactly. And it's hard to be a profile in courage in that kind of atmosphere that we have today in Washington. And as we mentioned before, when you see, and when someone stands up, future Julian Assange's, Edward Snowden's, if they look at that and see what happened to them, how likely are they going to be to do that? I mean, even an early crusader like Ralph Nader, who was kind of an early whistleblower as far as corporate America, he's kind of quieted down. Actually, Ralph Nader was supposed to write the introduction to my book, Survival of the Richest. I don't know what happened. Somehow he backed out at the last minute or something. So very disappointing. But I've always admired him, and I would have been totally honored with that. But even at that level, where he was really criticizing the car industry, but he was an honest guy. He had a lot of populism in him. That's why we talk about the left-right paradigm. If back when Pat Buchanan was running for president, another guy I admire very much, Pat Buchanan and Ralph Nader had very much in common. If they had coalesced together in the Reform Party, we might have had a chance. But again, they just can't overcome those cosmetic differences, whether it's over cultural issues and things like that. And we saw a little bit of that in this last campaign, where I think I don't hold Donald Trump or Bernie Sanders at the level of Ralph Nader or Pat Buchanan, but we saw some of the same kind of thing where if their supporters had come together, and you talk about Cynthia McKinney, I communicate with her once in a while. And during the Trump campaign, I asked her, I said, would you, I think it'd be a dream ticket if you were Trump's vice presidential candidate. She was very receptive to that. And I had a kind of a minor contact in the Trump campaign, and I just kind of floated the idea to them. They just shot
laughed.
It right down.
Yeah, whatever.
Unbeatable ticket. And they had a lot in common. They just, but again, they couldn't get past those cosmetic differences.
Yeah, well, Bernie Sanders would have been president if Hillary Clinton wouldn't have rigged the election.
Yes, exactly.
But it would have been a very different situation now. I just hope that, to actually take down the deep state and to do things, it's really hard. And, people still hold out hope that Trump's doing it and he has to play this 3D chess. I don't know.
Yeah.
I just sit and I look at actions, you laugh, and so do I, in the sense of who knows. I look at actions, what they say doesn't even matter to me anymore. I want to see what are they doing. Because it's so hard to, but you have this amazing book you read, or that you wrote, you have a couple that you've written, you write blogs. Can you tell us about it? I think your stuff is amazing.
Well, thank you. I'm different, like I said, because I'm a populist. My hero is Huey Long, and I think I'm single-handedly trying to restore his reputation. I've done a couple interviews about him recently, so that's where I am. I mean, I am a classical leftist or populist. I'm always for the little guy, always, whether it's, I don't like concentrated power anywhere, whether it's big business, big government, big labor, big anything. I don't like unfairness. I'm for real equality, not for special interest.
But free market, towards that, a true free market.
A true free market. But the problem is right now, the way the market, what I talk about in Survival of the Richest, can't defend this marketplace, because the marketplace that can't raise the minimum wage but can give a CEO like John Welch over $400 million when he leaves the company, and the same year the GE paid no taxes. We see that recently we saw with Amazon. Amazon paid no taxes.
Well, the problem with the minimum, you can always use the free market argument against the minimum wage, because it's true. The problem is we don't have a free market.
No, we don't.
That's the problem. And so you're trying to fix things because the free market's not working.
And I give you an example. One of the examples I use, and again, you're not going to hear anybody else talk about this, but I know a person that worked, I don't know if you're familiar with Safeway, the grocery store chain.
Yeah.
I mean, okay, so it's pretty national. Big grocery chain. I know somebody that worked at Safeway as a cashier back in the early 1980s. He was making $17 an hour, which is $35,000 a year then. Translated into 2018 money, that's over $112,000 a year. Same job, same job, same company today, less than $10 an hour. Circuit City, another giant back in the 80s again. Their salesmen were routinely making in the mid-30s. Again, over $100,000 a year. They don't even exist anymore, but the company, they went out of business. But it wasn't because of that, because they cut out the commissions for sales well before they went out of business, trying to save money. But my point is, those aren't the only two companies. Those are the companies I know of firsthand. That's what no one talks about. The left doesn't talk about that. How did jobs used to pay so much more, average jobs? Now they tell you retail's a joke. It's, you can't make a living off it, and you can't. But it's because they don't pay a living wage. Back in the 60s and 70s, fathers existed who worked in Sears, Montgomery Ward's, places like that, who just did regular jobs behind a counter. They had a single family home. Their wives didn't work. They had as many kids as they wanted. They lived that middle class lifestyle. Why was that?
Free market existed more than it does now. We mean, we had problems too, but not like we do now. Yeah. And it's all these trade agreements, because now we're competing worldwide. And so our wages, it's balancing out with China and Mexico,
right?
Whenever. Even Mexico complains that now they have to compete with China, because
right.
Mexico's wages are a lot higher than China's wages.
Yeah.
I mean, it's hard to compete. And so our trade agreements have to realize we have to protect our way of life to a certain degree and help them go up. We got to be smarter and don't give them incentives to be able to sell their product at a lower. I mean, like our post office gives them incentives so they ship for less. Why are you giving them an incentive to sell things locally?
Again, every move they make is the wrong move. And because they're not interested in raising anyone's wages. As you mentioned, that Mexico can't compete with China. We can't compete with any of them because we traditionally paid people a living wage. At least in the past we did. But now what is happening is we're emulating a society like China. That's why you're seeing these micro apartments and things like that become popular. They're trying to get Americans to lower their expectations. They want their standard of living to go down. Be happy to live in a bunk bed with somebody in an 8x10 cubicle. This is what they want for Americans. And, you'll go to your job, we'll pay you just enough to eat, our overinflated prices, that kind of thing. We don't have great mass transit for you, so somehow you're going to have to be able to find a car to drive or whatever. But this is the expectations that our young people are having to look forward to now. And it's all because we're emulating a society like China. We've outsourced much of our industry to China or to third world nations. And we can't, because the only reason, the main reason, is because of cheap labor. Those companies realized, hey, that's going to, man, if I'm in these factories, I was paying somebody $15 to $20 an hour to start, gave them great benefits. I can go to Thailand or China or wherever, and I'm going to be paying them, $10 a day or whatever they're paying them. No benefits. If they die on the job, I don't have to worry about anybody coming to ask me questions about it. That's the kind of thing that we have to get. They realize that the only reason they exist at this point, the only reason somebody goes into business apparently now, is to make as much money as possible. And that seems to be their only guiding principle. In the old days, you had even the plutocrats of the past, the robber barons, at least treated their workers decently. As Henry Ford said, I got to pay them enough to buy the product. They didn't exploit them to the degree that we see now. And apparently they never got the idea, you know, I'm going to make 1,000 times more than my worker does. Back in, you know, the 60s and 70s, they didn't even call them CEOs, but the president of the company oftentimes was the founder, or, you know, the son or grandson or whatever of the founder. They had a real personal stake in the country. They had an interest in it. They wanted to see their workers happy enough. And at least they had some of that. Now, there doesn't seem to be anything like that. We're like chess pieces. Yeah, we'll lay off 10,000 people.
We're headcount.
Lay off 10,000 people in his law. And that's going to make me get a bigger bonus this Christmas. That's all that counts.
Yeah, that's terrible. I'm going to get a bigger bonus if I lay these people off, so let's just get rid of them. And they don't have any sense of ethics. It's the ethics that we're losing. But, you know, I always say that the worst of our worst criminals, you know, whatever they are still better than some of this corruption that is so dark that these people at the top are doing. And if we don't get rid of that, we have no chance of fixing any of this. I mean, the corruption and that level of corruption, we can't have a society that functions at all for anybody on the left, right, any paradigm you think you believe in until we get rid of that corruption. Because you can't even have a basic conversation about things because nothing works. It's irrational.
And that's why Drain the Swamp was such a popular thing, because everybody realizes that it is a swamp. And that's why it's been so disappointing to see nothing but insiders in the swamp around Trump. And it's hilarious to see that he still talks about that. But that was something that really struck a chord in all of us. Yeah, that's the first thing we need to do is drain that swamp. As you mentioned, if you don't have honesty to begin with, because I've always believed that you could have – I loved Ron Paul. I believe, you know, that you could have an honest libertarian government. And I love Cynthia McKinney, or people. I voted for Cynthia McKinney for president in 2008. And I voted for Ron Paul in 2012. So you could have an honest left or right person.
Either one would be better than what we got.
Either one
now
would be better. I mean, it might work a little differently, but as you mentioned, the overriding interest there would be, are you going to be honest? Are you going to get rid of the corruption? You get rid of the corruption, and then there's various ways to do it. But whatever, there's so many ways to do it. What we're doing now is clearly not working for about 80% of the American people.
Yeah, or more, actually, because you still have to live in the society. You still have to raise the children with this kind of a mindset. And unless you have no ethics at all and you don't care about God and what's been taught and whatever your spirituality is, if you're not on the positive side of life, humanity, I mean, that if you are at all on that positive side, your kids have to be in this community. So anyways, will you share how people can get your work, what your website is, and, you know, give us your little plug.
Okay, well, my blog is Keeping It Unreal after my novel, The Unreals, that I wrote back in 2007, and it's donaldjeffries.wordpress.com. I'm real easy to find. My book, Hidden History, is still out there. It's still doing well. It has a foreword by Roger Stone, the paperback edition did, and Survival of the Richest is the newest book, and that's easy to find as well on Amazon, and it's in Barnes & Noble stores and so forth. If you Google me, you can find other interviews, you can find lots of stuff about me. I have a new book coming out next spring. It's going to be called Crimes and Cover-Ups in American Politics, 1776 to 1963. It's kind of a prequel to Hidden History, and we look at some of the older scandals and corruption going back to the birth of the country.
Well, that's good. I mean, people knowing history, maybe we can stop some of the what's going on now. Okay, well, thank you so much. And you're going to stick around for a couple of questions for my patrons.
Sure. Happy to do so. Thank you.